From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Just last week, anthrax traces were found on mail at the Federal Reserve in Washington. While test results may be a false positive, even the possibility is a frightening reminder that 7 months after a tabloid photo editor in Florida became the first victim, last fall's alarming anthrax campaign remains an unsolved murder mystery. And no solutions means no safety in this hour. The latest developments in the anthrax case and deadly unanswered questions over who done it. The first, the United States and Russia agreed today to make major reductions in their nuclear weapons arsenals. In a surprise announcement, President Bush said that slashing nuclear stockpiles will put the Cold War behind America and Russia once and for all. Earlier today, I spoke with NPR diplomatic correspondent Mike Schuster, and I asked him to describe the real significance of the new treaty.
All the experts say it's a big step forward because, in fact, over the course of the next 10 years, when these reductions in deployed weapons will be carried out, the number of strategic warheads deployed in both Russia and in the United States will be slashed from around 6,000 today on each side to eventually around 2,000, plus or minus a couple of hundred on each side. And most experts say that's an enormous reduction, and especially a huge reduction given the peaks during the Cold War of deployed strategic weapons of more than 10,000 on each side. Nevertheless, the United States is going to take many of those warheads, thousands in fact, that it's going to take out of deployment, out of missiles and bombers, and put them in storage so that they can be used again. It's not going to destroy them. There were some people who thought that when they were going to be taken out of missiles and bombers, they were actually going to be dismantled and made unusable again. But the Bush administration wants to keep thousands in reserve for possible use in the future.
Mike Schuster, if they're kept in reserve and not destroyed, does that count as a reduction in numbers? How significant is the gap between being in reserve and being at the ready?
Well, all the experts, those who support President Bush and those who are critical of him, say, yes, it counts as a reduction because the Bush administration is using the same counting method, that is, numbers of warheads deployed in the field that it could be actually launched or put on bombers, the same counting method that has been used in all the previous arms control agreements with first the Soviet Union and then with Russia. The two sides always counted the number of what they called the number of launchers, the number of missiles and how many warheads they carried, and the number of bombers and submarines and how many warheads they carried. And so, yes, this conforms to those counting methods. But because the United States and Russia had gotten to a point where they were no longer enemies, that was the position of the leadership of both sides. There was a lot of hope on the part of arms control advocates that those warheads that were taken out of deployment, out of active deployment, would actually be destroyed. And so there's a good deal of disappointment there. Still, it's fair to say that the United States government will be counting deployed strategic warheads in much the same way as it has in the past.
President Bush came into office saying he'd like to make this reduction on a handshake. Why did he prefer that path, and why was it so important to the Russians that it be based in a treaty?
Well, he preferred to do it on a handshake because his advisors really were reluctant to commit the United States to any further reductions where they might not be able to have maximum flexibility vis-a-vis the American nuclear arsenal in the future. There are a lot of people around President Bush, both in the White House and especially in the Pentagon and also in the State Department, who believe that threats could arise in the future that are unexpected, that would be surprises, where the United States might need a much larger nuclear arsenal than the eventually reduced one that we're talking about now. And they advised the president to maintain maximum flexibility, given that the U.S. and Russia are no longer enemies. They argued there's no reason to actually put this down in a treaty. The Russians weren't happy with that because financially they are strapped and couldn't match the United States in the future, or are fearful that they couldn't match the United States in the future if there was a buildup. And so the Russians wanted to nail down, lock-in reductions now in the form of a treaty. There was also some view in the Senate, both in the Republican and Democratic parties in the Senate, that they wanted to pass as well on these reductions, that they wanted it in the form of a treaty. That's the issue that the United States gave little way on. the Russians also wanted some commitment to actually destroying or dismantling the weapons that are going to be put in storage, and the United States did not give any way on that. So there seemed to have been a quid pro quo. The Russians got a binding treaty, but the United States got a warehouse full of weapons in reserve.
And how much does that treaty mean? Even before George Bush came into office, he made clear he intended to move beyond the ABM treaty's limitations to employ a missile defense system, and of course that was a treaty as well. Is a treaty seen as a big stone immovable marker here or not?
Well, don't forget the anti-ballistic missile treaty went into effect in 1972, so it lasted for 30 years. And it's legitimate that statesmen and political leaders might say, as history marches on, that the circumstances can change and that treaties would have to be discarded or amended. I don't think that that's not unusual given the history of nations. But certainly every time presidents, certainly American presidents, sign a treaty and submit it to the Senate for ratification, I think that they intend it to be U.S. policy for the foreseeable future.
President Bush said today that this marks a decisive move beyond the Cold War. In many ways, the world has clearly moved beyond the Cold War even without this step. The focus of defense strategists' concerns haven't been those missiles for a while.
No, I think that that's true. I don't think that this is anything new. The United States, in its attitude toward nuclear weapons and the deployment of offensive nuclear weapons, has been trying to move beyond the Cold War for quite some time. There were developments in Russia and in the United States during the Clinton administration that got in the way of that sometimes. But it certainly has been the intention of presidents since George Bush the Elder and through the Clinton administration to move beyond the Cold War. And I think this is a continuation of that.
And Mike Schuster, finally, the outlook for ratification by the U.S. Senate, and when might we see this treaty signed?
It's hard to predict. President Clinton was reluctant to submit treaties to the then Republican-dominated Congress, but President Bush is unlikely to hold it back. The Democrats and Republicans, both, particularly in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which we'll see at first, are likely to embrace this. There'll probably be some interesting hearings and maybe some argument about it. But at this stage, it doesn't look like the Senate will do anything but embrace it wholeheartedly.
Mike Schuster, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Mike Schuster is diplomatic correspondent for National Public Radio. Less than a month after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, America faced a new enemy, anthrax, in the mail, triggering a bioterror scare and a run on Cipro. Just five people died, a photo editor, two mail carriers, an elderly woman, and a hospital worker. But for weeks, high-profile venues were paralyzed, and the whole country came face-to-face with bio-vulnerability. Months later, there are new insights, but no arrests. What's going on here? How is it that the FBI does not seem to have begun to crack this case? And where are you in all of this? What's your anthrax awareness these days? Are you still eyeing your mail suspiciously or just ripping it open like the old days? Are we any smarter or safer than we were 7 months ago? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Gene Gelman, professor of sociology at Boston College and a senior advisor at MIT's Security Studies Program. She's author of Anthrax, The Investigation of a Deadly Outbreak. Good evening and welcome, Gene Gelman.
Good evening.
With us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly and our On Point news analyst. Good evening. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Gene Gelman, what is going on? The word that we get is that there's been no real substantive headway in this investigation, that we're no closer to having a culprit in hand, having the anthrax killer today than we were 7 months ago. Is that a fair assessment?
That's a very fair assessment. There's been tremendous energy invested by the FBI over these 7 months or so, trying to find a culprit, searching out all sorts of clues and evidence. And basically, I think coming up against the reality that although we talk about anthrax in epidemiological terms, we talk about it as a disease, and we think about the consequences that it had for the 11 people who got inhalation anthrax, that basically we're talking about a biological weapon. And one of the problems is that when you're in the weapons area, inevitably, when you're trying to do your research, and this does apply to the FBI, you're going to come up against some walls called national security. That is, that there are things going on concerning biological weapons in the defensive programs that the United States has and in other countries where they also have defensive programs that are not going to be revealed to the FBI, that in fact there will be a wall and that the investigative trail is going to stop at that wall.
So you're suggesting, Gene Gilman, that the so-called anthrax mystery may be in part or more than part a mystery of our own governments or other governments making, that when they try and track the trail of anthrax, it leads to biolabs that just aren't going to open their doors? So this investigation is up against that kind of wall?
Yes, I think it is. I think the minute we heard Senator Daschle back on October 17th telling the nation that what had come to him in a letter, come to his office in a letter, was weapons grade, that the entire framework for understanding the anthrax terrorism attacks shifted over to a more military framework. It shifted over to the question of biological weapons. I think up until that point, people were speaking in terms of the terrorist, this anthrax terrorist, as someone maybe who did it in his basement, you know, grew anthrax in his basement.
Found a moldy old cowhide.
Exactly. An amateur, right? Mm-hmm. But I think as soon as the Daschle letter's contents were understood to be weapons grade, and they are, then the framework, again, it shifted over, and we had to say, well, wait a minute. Who's capable of doing this? And when we began to ask the question, I think as a nation or the FBI as an agency began to ask the question, who's capable of this? It has come back to the United States.
We've met the enemy, and the enemy is us. Is it just, my reaction to this is that this is doubly unsettling. This is doubly frightening if we can't investigate the crime against Americans because American security agencies may be the source. Are you suggesting even the perpetrator somehow of this
well,
crime?
Well, I don't know. All I know is that after a certain point, the FBI is not able to proceed forward because, in fact, we have an issue about weapons and national security. And the tragedy of this, by the way, is that the kind of work that is done in the area of biological weapons defensively, you know, looking at different kinds of anthrax or looking at different kinds of vaccines and things like that, is not really a primary weapons issue. I mean, nuclear weapons are a primary issue.
There's been a ban for decades in the United States on bioweaponry.
Exactly. And you know, biological weapons, in effect, have really not been used in battlefield war. We had a program for 27 years. This stuff never went out on the battlefield. And I don't think it was moral repugnance. I think that it was very inefficient, very indiscriminate, very hard to use. Stuff blows all over the place. Bombing was always better. So it's unfortunate that I do believe we have a national security issue, which is in conflict with giving full information, not simply to the FBI, but to the Centers for Disease Control or to local level people who want to know what the real threat is of anthrax.
Jack Peaty, here's an investigator's conundrum. It sounds right out of some kind of a spy thriller where they cannot, Gene Gilman suggesting, track down this anthrax killer because the source of the anthrax, perhaps even the terrorist in this case, is associated with our own security agencies, possibly.
Yeah, I don't want to betray undue naivete, but I find it shocking. I mean, in face of the publicity, in face of the crisis that closed down Congress, to think that there's not more cooperation within the bureaucracies here and that there's a kind of national security red flag, as you say, it's like out of John le Carre, like a rogue. Is this the Fort Detrick business, Professor Gelman?
This is the Ames strain that was kept in Maryland?
Fort Detrick in Maryland doesn't really do anything with virulent anthrax, or it has not done anything with virulent anthrax until recently when it began to look more closely at what was in the Daschle letter and then the letter that went to Senator Leahy. But there are certainly other programs that we have heard about and that have certainly been in the newspaper where, in fact, they have dealt with virulent anthrax. There are five other laboratories outside of Fort Detrick that we know about.
We're going to get into that intersection between these crimes and what we know about U.S. agencies handling anthrax. We're talking about the anthrax scare of last fall. What's happened to it? Did it just evaporate? Why haven't we tracked down the anthrax killer? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
from Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about anthrax, the missing anthrax killer. Why haven't we tracked down the anthrax culprit who had the entire nation on its toes last fall, wondering who could, who would, who might be next? How safe are we today when the postal system can still be an anthrax delivery system? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Jean Gilman. She's professor of sociology at Boston College and a senior advisor at MIT's Security Studies Program. Jean Gilman, you've just in the last couple of days come back from Washington where you were talking with people who were at sort of the epicenter of the anthrax outbreak in the Senate's Hart Office Building, I believe, and in one or two of the Postal Service sorting centers in Washington. What were you looking at there? What did you find? What did you learn?
I wanted to know how both groups, the people who were in the Hart Building when the Daschle letter was opened and who had to evacuate that building, and also how the postal workers at Brentwood were feeling about the trauma, really, of last October and November. And I found a very interesting difference between the two of them. The Hart Senate office building right now is all cleaned up and everybody's back at work. Mm-hmm. And I think in many ways, except for those who were immediately affected by the letter, the people who were on Senator Daschle's staff, I think many other people in the building have just moved on. They don't think about the risks anymore. They put the trauma behind them.
Like the country, in a way.
I think very much like the country. They got their Cipro very early on. There were no deaths, even though there were many exposures to anthrax spores. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say many. There are about 30 people or so
at the Senate building.
But the Brentwood postal workers are having much more difficulty moving on. They lost two people. Two of the postal workers died, and the other two who were seriously ill remain rather ill, debilitated by the inhalation anthrax they experienced.
Is that facility back up and in operation now?
No, the Brentwood postal facility, a very large facility in the southeast area of. The northeast area of Washington, is still closed, and it's a subject of great controversy because it's not clear how it will be cleaned up to the satisfaction of the workers. And we're up against a very serious question here about trust in government. Mm-hmm. And I think the Brentwood people are a little bit like the miners' canaries, if I can use that oft-used expression, in the sense that they feel that their trust of government has really been eroded seriously. And that's in part because it took the government some time to shut down that facility after the Daschle letter was discovered.
They didn't feel cared for in the same way that people in the Senate office building were cared for.
No, absolutely not. Although
they weren't, right?
They weren't, but those are not completely comparable situations because the letter did come to Senator Daschle's office, mm-hmm. and it was a hot spot, as they say, and you could react. It was the back chaining. It was people at the CDC, for example, really failing to think back, oh, my goodness, where could this have disseminated? Where could this be a danger for other people?
Are there postal officials who want to reopen that facility? It must be a big and important one for the Capitol. So is this a sort of a job action or a union issue that they don't want it opened, or is it a scientific issue that it's just clearly not safe?
I think it's more a scientific issue. I think it's a question of can they fumigate it and can they really make it a safe environment. Those machines, for example, that are in there, the sorters, pass mail through at 30 miles an hour. Can they really clean the machines that they know got very, very dirty from the Leahy and Daschle letters? That's part one. And then part two, can they really set up an environment so people will trust it and feel that if there were another letter, they would be protected?
It raises the question of national vulnerability again. If such a huge sorting facility can be shut down just by a couple of letters, are we not still vulnerable nationally to the entire Postal Service being disrupted if this kind of distribution had been at more centers?
Yes, I think that's a question we're all asking, but it goes back to who did it again. And then the question becomes, why hasn't it happened again? And I think that's a very important question. That may never be answered. We had, for example, the great Tylenol scare where a number of years ago where some bioterrorist of that sort actually killed people by infecting Tylenol. Are we going to be in a situation where we'll never know? And that's a terrible situation for us to be in.
Jack Beatty, this feels like a deeper and murkier mystery than I had even imagined coming into this hour.
It does, and I at least don't take any comfort from the fact that the FBI is leading it. I mean, just from anecdotal reports in the press about the way the FBI has handled this in its relations with other agencies, especially the Centers for Disease Control, in its conduct in New York, it has just shown the kind of bureaucratic build up a wall and hide behind it behavior of the FBI that we have come to just identify as almost definitive of that agency. Plus, the FBI, I mean, my hypothesis, if I were a city editor, would be, is this agency more invested in covering up its own lacks relative to September 11th and anthrax? Or is it using those energies to really go out and find who's there? And then second, is the ideologized Justice Department under John Ashcroft, where you've got his assistants or, you know, from all reports, are members of the Federalist Society. They're more concerned with sort of ideological pictures of the world than with real problem solving, whether that kind of leadership is the right leadership to deal with so practical and so intricate and so politically charged a problem.
Let's look at the FBI question first. They've conducted 5,000 interviews, we're told, issued more than 1,300 subpoenas in this case, seized numerous samples, and even given lie detector tests to several scientists. Are they doing all they should and could, Jean Gilman?
I'm not as critical of the FBI as Jack is. My feeling is that it's an agency in contradistinction to the CIA, for example, which actually is trying to get facts and actually tries to investigate and tries to turn over stones. And yes, absolutely, they have blundered. But I would say that there's a lot of shame to go around in this whole case. And I think the CDC, if you wanted to do a comparison, I think the CDC has been much more addle-brained than the FBI.
Why so?
Well, for example, when the Florida case came on the screen back in October of last year, the CDC spent almost two entire days investigating only one hypothesis, and that is that the man had gotten anthrax because he had been on a hunting trip. They never considered
this just weeks after a terrorist attack on the country.
Absolutely. And the papers full of the threat of biological weapons and their own considerable investment in the issue of bioterrorism, they could not think out of the box, and they wasted two crucial days, putting the people who were in that American media building, I think, at risk.
And to Jack's question about the Department of Justice, do you see them pushing in a wholehearted fashion on this case?
Well, this speaks to the question, is the FBI really autonomous and able to do its work? And I think that that remains a question. Certainly the people that I know at the FBI have had a tremendously sharp upward learning curve in terms of the science of anthrax. Mm-hmm. And I can say that with confidence. But again, is there a problem here about what can be known and what cannot be known, and how much can the FBI do when we come back to this issue of national security?
We've got to talk some more about that issue of weapons-grade anthrax and the potential link to national security. But I want to ring Carlos in first. Liv is on the line. Welcome, Liv. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Fine, thanks.
This is maybe very far-fetched, but it's always struck me curious that there was a woman, I don't recall her name, who died in New York, and nobody had any idea where her contact with anthrax was.
Mm-hmm.
And then it seemed that so many of the anthrax things stopped, all the people receiving letters, except for in Connecticut, where there were a couple of elderly people who were affected, and they thought that was through the Postal Service.
So what thought does that leave you with, Liv?
Maybe she had something to do with it. I don't know. I know it sounds kind of crazy.
Mm.
It seemed bizarre, and I was always curious.
Thanks for the question. Jean Gilman, what about the sort of public end of the trail here? Was that, in fact, the end of the trail, or did we just stop hearing about it? I see there's a new report out just today, or at least a new version of it, where scientists have said that there was a lot of cross-contamination of letters in these sorting centers, that the cross-contamination probably led to just those deaths in New York, in Connecticut, that they went through a machine where other letters had gone through, perhaps on the way to NBC. But what about the end of the trail? Was that the end of the trail? Or where is it?
Well, speaking of those two women, the one the hospital worker in New York and the other an elderly mm-hmm. woman in Connecticut, mm-hmm. It's fairly sure that they caught inhalation anthrax. They got inhalation anthrax through having inhaled spores that were on contaminated letters. This shouldn't have been that much of a surprise, except that going back to October and November, there was a kind of a mantra going around that you really couldn't get inhalation anthrax unless you had a dose of 8,000 to 10,000 spores or more, unless you had basically inhaled that. Mm-hmm. Of course, this wasn't true. The work that I did in Russia on the outbreak in Sverdlovsk in the former Soviet Union, and that Matthew Meselson has also mm-hmm. done, mm-hmm. Showed very clearly that only a few spores actually could give you inhalation anthrax when you really thought about it. Mm. In fact, only one spore could give you inhalation anthrax.
Would be enough. And what about this point that the anthrax powder became finer and more potent, apparently, from one mailing to the next? Why? What's the thinking on that?
Well, that's something that is being promoted a bit in the press right now, and I don't think it's
a red herring.
I don't think it's a terribly important issue. I think we know weapons grade equals weapons grade. So you might be able to say, well, there's a distinction between the Brokaw letter and the Dashiell and Leahy letters or something like that, that one of them is a bit more purified than the others. But I think you could, in doing that and concentrating on these rather finer points, that you lose track of the fact this is all weapons grade. And this is not the stuff that's made in garages by amateurs. This is actually military work.
So what are you suggesting when you say that? If it's weapons grade, does that mean that it had to come from U.S. military sources somehow? Could it not have come from overseas? How many people have access to that sort of anthrax, weapons grade?
Well, I think we have to emphasize here the skill that it would take to do it.
Do what exactly?
To grow and process the anthrax so that it was fit to be aerosolized and therefore become very dangerous as a powder.
Now, when you say that, are you suggesting that someone may have done that outside of a military lab, or that it took skill within some kind of security setting? That this was likely done by an individual who had learned in a security setting how to do it, or that this is anthrax that might have been produced in a military facility and then somehow taken out by a rogue scientist?
Well, I think we're all in the realm of speculation.
Yes, we
here.
Are.
So, but I think it's not an unreasonable speculation that it came from a laboratory and that somebody actually picked it up and left a laboratory with it. I don't think that's an unreasonable speculation at all.
So does that then suggest a U.S. source or a foreign source, or does it make a difference?
I think the United States would have to look to itself first, since we have been the major promoters of this kind of weapon, and we have done more work with it, I would believe, than other countries.
Even than the Soviets in their day?
I think the feedback we've gotten from the Soviet scientists who have worked in that program was that the material that was sent around was perhaps even beyond what they could do, what they could have done.
John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
So I'd like to maybe change direction for just a second. But
okay.
My point is more about not so much where did the anthrax come from, but more about where did the story go. Because what's interesting to me as sort of a side note here is that this was really the biggest story in our collective consciousness for weeks.
It was huge.
It was huge. And then other than this show tonight, I've heard nothing about it really for, you know, well, it's been a few weeks at mm-hmm. least.
It's an interesting question, John. Let me put it to Gene Gilman. And Gene, I don't know if you follow the press acrobatics on this, but there has been quite a well of silence that seems to have grown around anthrax.
There's been a lot of press silence on it, but there's been a lot of activity behind the scenes. The Homeland Security effort, for example, the distribution of money, the enormous growth in the budget for everything connected with Homeland Security is very much fueled by that anthrax scare and by the series of scares. So local level emergency domestic preparedness teams are popping up all over the United States. Every state in the union is getting millions of dollars. Some of them are getting tens of millions of dollars to promote domestic preparedness, again, very much with an emphasis on either anthrax as a possible bioweapon or smallpox as a bioweapon.
But the one case that we actually have that's sitting in our lap, we can't solve.
We have not been able to solve it, but the scare factor, the fright value of it, has translated directly into a big budget, a lot of activity in Washington, and a lot of activity across the land in local communities.
I wonder, though, if from the to John's question on the press side, if there's no evidence, if there's no movement in an investigation, it doesn't give the press much to grab onto.
That's right.
Kim is on the line. Welcome, Kim. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My question relates very much to what you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's another piece of speculation. Say, for example, if the attacks last fall came from the Fort Detrick area.
This is where the Ames strain of anthrax was in Maryland.
Correct. If they came from that particular fort,
mm-hmm.
Might it have been part of a government motive to generate public anxiety that you were just talking about bioterrorism and possibly increase the approval rate for the anthrax vaccine immunization program run by the DOD?
Well, Kim, thank you for your call. I mean, Gene Gilman, you know, this invites speculation because there hasn't been more progress. Here's one question from Kim. Might this have somehow been deliberate? Does that ring any bell of credibility in your mind?
Well, I think what's really striking about Kim's very good question is the lack of trust in government and linking the whole anthrax scare back to a really unfortunate program, the one that she's mentioned, which was the called AVIP. It's the universal vaccination program for vaccinating everyone in the military against anthrax. And this was promoted by the Clinton administration, actually, in the beginning of 1998. And it's a fiasco and a scandal, I think, would be the polite way of referring to that vaccination
program.
What
about it was a scandal? It wasn't effective or it wasn't employed?
Well, the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, contracted with a private company of entrepreneurs to produce anthrax vaccine. After 3 to 4 years, they haven't produced a single vial of anthrax vaccine, and the Army is actually running out of anthrax vaccine, and this company has made a profit. And I think that's the scandal part of it. The other part of it, of course, is that the need was not universal. Not everyone in the military was at risk for getting anthrax.
But is it wholly far-fetched to think, as Kim kind of suggests here, that someone who wanted that program pushed forward might have waved the warning envelope, scattered some spores around in hopes that that would then become a reality in the military budget?
Well, I don't know what the motivation was. I can't even begin to guess at the motivation. If you read the letters that went along with the anthrax samples, you know you're dealing with someone who is who's capable of just about anything and whose motivation is certainly sociopathic at best.
Yeah, we don't want to walk you too far on this plank of speculation, but here we are without knowing, and we want to be sure that we get to what's deep in your mind about what might be going on here in the absence of knowing what is going on here. John, wow. Anthrax. We're talking about the anthrax killer, the anthrax that was spread around the east coast of this country last fall. Here we are. 5,000 interviews by the FBI later, more than 1,300 subpoenas, lie detector tests for scientists, samples seized, and no conclusion, no real forward movement that we can see. Why haven't we tracked down the anthrax killer? Where would you look for the anthrax culprit? And can the U.S. ever be free from this anthrax threat? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the mystery of last fall's anthrax attacks. They seem to come out of nowhere. They seem to have gone away to nowhere in the aftermath. A lot of activity by the FBI, but so far, no suspects, not even a real sense of forward progress. Why haven't we tracked down the anthrax killer? And have we made, as a country, anthrax just another threat we can live with? If we can't stop anthrax, what biothreat can we stop? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Gene Gilman, a professor of sociology at Boston College and author of Anthrax, The Investigation of a Deadly Outbreak. Gina, I know you've been in touch with FBI people. What sense do you have of where their path has led? What are the rabbit holes they've gone down where they've come up with nothing? Where does the investigation stand now?
Well, there's been progress made, I think, in some of the scientific movement that they've had. I mean, we do understand the anthrax samples better than we have done. There's some better understanding of the DNA that has proceeded pretty much apace.
And does that tell us that they are indeed related?
Yes, I think we're coming back to the...
All the letters, then.
They seem to be pretty much the same thing. And
we know, of course, this the simple, wonderful old thing that the cellophane tape, they cellophane, say, was torn off the same roll of tape.
This the is same roll of tape.
Good old gumshoe microscope investigation.
Exactly. And so there's a new impetus to look at New Jersey again, to where the letters were originally mailed, to go back there again, and also to go back and, in a sense, reevaluate the Florida material. And the Florida situation, which was the very first instance, but in a way hasn't totally fit the pattern of the New York and the Washington, D.C. attacks.
Mm-hmm. And we read in the press that the CIA has not been entirely helpful in this investigation. What do we know about that, the interaction between FBI and CIA?
Well, I think we know from the Judy Miller book, Germs, that came out last fall, that the CIA had secret black box programs, or at least one, where they were dealing with some very virulent strain of anthrax, and in a way that actually didn't add to our national security, but they saw that as a national security issue.
They were dealing with this as an offensive weapon or as part of a defensive program?
They were dealing with it as part of a defensive program, but you know, there's a line you can get very
sure.
close to where you say, listen, I have to know everything that an enemy could do to me. So if I think an enemy is going to come up with a mutant form of anthrax that's resistant to all antibiotics, for example, then I'd better develop that mutant form of anthrax so I can understand it better. And I think that was the frame of reference for them, and that was their way of proceeding with a defensive program.
Judy Miller called that a black box operation. What do we know about how forthcoming the CIA has been in the FBI's investigation?
Well, I think we also know this from the press now, that the CIA has not been forthcoming as much as it could be. And we do have it's the CIA, but there's also the Defense Intelligence Agency. There can be a kind of a culture of secrecy in and around weapons. I mean, it's a problem of this particular kind of weapon, but also the fact that it is a weapon. So there is a culture of secrecy, which, in fact, is not in the public interest.
And in your world, among people who think about anthrax, who see what's going on here, are there presumptions that have been made? Do people think, well, this must be a rogue scientist who's kind of, you know, lost it Unabomber style? Or is there a sense that this might be more institutionally related somehow?
Well, I think Barbara Hatch Rosenberg, who is with the Federation of American Scientists, has been very much out front with the idea that this is a rogue scientist, that this is somebody trained by the U.S. who has basically gone awry.
That makes the conspiracy theories look a little bit less likely, if we buy that. Then it doesn't look like someone promoting this or that weapons or vaccination program on the backs of four letters sent here and there.
No, this is hard to know. Is this somebody who's in the club or out of the club?
Oh, we're deep in the woods here. Pamela's on the line. Welcome, Pamela. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Question kind of follows up from what you've just been discussing, and I don't know if there's really an answer to it, but how do you separate the government's need, or the CIA's need, I suppose, in this case, to or the FBI's to sort of withhold information that will allow them to continue to follow on leads
mm-hmm.
against the public's need to know the latest of what's going on, and how can we mm-hmm. interpret what we're hearing in the news to understand where that line is being drawn?
It's a good question, Pamela. Thanks for it. Gene Gilman, what about it? Are we just looking at agencies that may be on top of it but can't tell us that they're on top of it because
yes.
it would jeopardize their investigation?
Yes. I'd like to point out here that the culture of secrecy spreads. The Centers for Disease Control, for example, now can classify its documents. That's a new thing. They can actually produce information and write reports and then declare that those reports cannot be seen by the public. Now,
but Pamela's looking at this in a hopeful way. Maybe we're closer to solving this than we think, that kind of secrecy. What do you think?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I see the culture of secrecy as actually spreading at the level of federal agencies.
In a way that's helpful to an investigation of an incident?
No,
like
in a
this?
Way that is not helpful to investigation. I'm very much anti-secrecy when it comes to things like disease and epidemics and even weapons. I think that particularly biological weapons, we really have to be as open as possible because it's the general public that suffers. It's civilians that are the objects of vulnerability in terms of biological weapons.
Jack Beatty, Gene Gilman says when she heard the phrase weapons grade, that opened up this entire door. And what a world on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that that one department isn't sharing with another department, I mean, it is scary. And scarier still to me is the report in Sunday's Times about the current state of things in federal agencies. The Inspector General for the Agriculture Department, for example, looked at places where they handle anthrax, and they write, although the laboratories themselves are required to maintain an inventory of their biological agents, only some did so, and some of those we reviewed were not accurate. This is about agriculture laboratories today.
Gene Gibbons, what about it? How safe should we feel about existing stocks of anthrax or other bioagents that are in government hands right now?
Well, the agriculture people, because they also deal with veterinary diseases and things like that, are, I think, in a bit of trouble now. All these federal labs have had, I think, rather lax security, and that's been almost across the board.
And any general oversight from Tom Ridge in the Homeland Security Office or anywhere else?
Well, I think the Washington word about Tom Ridge is that he's a person with influence, but not a person with power.
Gene Gilman, you have raised more questions than you've answered tonight, but it's very illuminating, and we thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Gene Gilman is professor of sociology at Boston College and senior advisor to MIT's Security Studies Program. She's author of Anthrax, The Investigation of a Deadly Outbreak. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, the curtain falls on one of opera's great careers. This is On Point. Front-page headlines in Friday's New York Post summed up a tumultuous weekend in the opera world. It read, "The Fat Man Won't Sing." Luciano Pavarotti was scheduled to sing the lead in the Metropolitan Opera's season-ending production of Puccini's Tosca. The performance was supposed to be the tenor's Metropolitan Swan Song, but citing a sudden case of the flu, Pavarotti bowed out just 90 minutes before showtime. Now it seems likely that one of the opera world's biggest stars will call it a career without a farewell performance at the Met. We caught up with two longtime observers of the opera scene earlier today, and they offered this appreciation.
What makes Luciano Pavarotti so special, I think, is several things. One is a wonderful, cultivated, God-given talent. He had a marvelous voice and used it magnificently for a long and distinguished career. He also has an extraordinary personal warmth, so that as a performer, he's one of those people who reaches across the footlights and really makes the audience feel as if they are a part of the musical experience in a very warm and intimate way. I think the third is that Mr. Pavarotti went beyond opera. He stopped being an opera star and became truly a household name in the popular culture. And in that way, he built bridges to the art form for people who might never have thought about listening to it, and served the art form, served the business very well.
What's made him a legendary figure, I think, is that he brings such intensity to his performances. He's a major actor, though he sometimes, as far as I was concerned, didn't necessarily show an awful lot of it on his face. His intensity, the way he uses his body and what he brings to his characters, is a very intense kind of character.
There has been a lot of talk quite a while about the fact that Mr. Pavarotti's stage career, that is in staged opera, was probably nearing an end. He has been having some mobility problems, and certainly just the rigors of traveling from continent to continent and singing through the very demanding athletic opera performances, there were many signs that that was wearing on Mr. Pavarotti. He certainly was becoming ill and was having to cancel performances. So I would say that the end of his career as a performer in staged opera was anticipated, and we are not surprised that it's come to an end. I don't think we're surprised either that, unfortunately, he was ill at the very end, because, indeed, the rigors of that career are something that are wearing on a man who had reached the age of 66.
As a singer who had to say goodbye herself, having sung at the Met for 12 years, it was very difficult for me to make the transition to teaching. I'm delighted that I did it, but the transition was hard. And because a singer and an actor is always a singer and an actor, and one never leaves. And so it's a very difficult thing to close that door. And I think perhaps emotionally it might have just been a little bit too much for him, because it was billed as such a farewell kind of thing. And I think the pressure on him was just too great for him. And maybe emotionally, he just didn't think he could handle it. But I'd like to think that he wasn't being irresponsible, though it did come across as irresponsible. But I have a feeling that it was probably, therefore, an emotional decision as opposed to an intellectual one. And at the age of 66, he's had a wonderful career, and he's done a lot of singing. And so if he has to stop now, I hope he's a happy human being. He certainly should be. He certainly brought an awful lot of joy to a lot of people, and particularly with the three tenor concerts and so forth, he's brought it to many more people than would have had it to begin with.
I think Mr. Pavarotti will be remembered very, very favorably. He is someone who really sang his repertoire as well as it could be sung. He was truly an artist in the Italian lyrico spinto repertoire, who is at the top of his form. He'll also be remembered, I think, by many people for whom he was the introduction to opera, where they loved the sound of his voice, they loved his personality, and through him, they discovered opera as a really exciting cultural expression in their own lives.
Mark Skorka is the president of Opera America. After 12 years singing with the Metropolitan Opera Company, Patricia Craig now teaches voice at the New England Conservatory. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.